I apologize for being late. We got Herb and I got held up at a UCEDA board meeting at over at the other building, and here we are now. So I'd like to call the meeting to order, and we'll start with a pledge of the flag.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. So we were mailed the minutes from our August 3rd meeting. I'll accept a motion to approve the minutes or as written, or if anyone has an amendment to them that they'd like to make.
Make a motion.
I'll second it.
Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
Okay, great. Thank you. So we have a few resolutions, not a lot. I'll start with resolution number 325, which is establishing the Ulster County Land Bank Development Corporation, a New York State land bank. Legislative Bartels is here, right? And I think you want to request that we postpone this another month, but we would like to discuss it a little bit tonight. Is that fair?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
I'll make a motion that we postpone it.
Okay. Well, before, let's make a motion for discussion, and then we'll postpone.
Okay.
Thank you.
So I'll move to discuss.
Yes.
Second.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Okay. Tracy, would you like to fill us in a little bit about where you are here?
Yes, and I know that legislator Uchitel has information to add to, because there have been some meetings, some discussion. I would very much like this to remain on the table for consideration. One of the challenges in the immediate, in terms of taking this as a parallel or even a singular path for the county, is we need to have the names for all the board members in order to move forward, which is the first reason why I don't want to move forward this month. But in the interim between last month and this month, we did have a meeting, and a legislator you tell will be able to update with more detail. We did have a meeting, members of the legislature, with Kingston City Land Bank, which I thought was really positive and helpful and informative, because obviously the first aim and the first goal would be to work together to have one countywide land bank that included the city. And the question is, how do we do that, and would the city be amenable to that option? And I think that our next step probably is to be prepared to go to the city with a proposal for what we, the county, would like to see in terms of the possibility of a countywide land bank. I'd like to hand it over to legislator. You should probably give a little more of the details of that.
Yeah, thank you. So if I may, Chairman. So we met with the director of the City of Kingston Land Bank, and some of the takeaways from that meeting are a couple of things, and there have actually been some further conversations, and I think with the Housing Development Corporation there have been even further conversations. So the status as I see it is, and Tracy, jump in if I'm not characterizing this correctly, the City of Kingston is potentially open to partnering, and part of the, you know, there's the challenge of figuring out what the structure looks like and honoring the contributions of their members, which is very important to them because they've put a lot of work to get where they are today, and then also determining what role the city would play in it and so on and so forth. But they're very open to that conversation. Their current trajectory and what they're working on transacting the properties that they have is going to run its course at some point, and they are going to have an inflection point where they determine what to do next. And it might be that they don't continue in the direction that they're going in. It might be that they double down on the direction that they're going in. So I think that's kind of a critical question for what type of entity they're going to be, or really when they're going to hit that inflection point, because that's probably the point at which it makes sense for us to engage with them. Mm-hmm. I think at the end of the day, what I suspect we all care about the most is that we're able to get people into homes, and that we're able to take some of the homes that might be eligible for this type of thing and put them to good use, get them on the tax rolls, get people in there so that they've got roofs over their heads. And that's why I think we should continue to explore the City of Kingston and continue to, you know, explore doing it on our own, because there's no reason that you have to wait for one for the other. We could potentially go forward on both of them. In the interim, I thought we had a pretty positive conversation with Deputy Director Wright about or sorry, deputy executive, right, about the potential for the Housing Development Corporation to do some work in that type of space in terms of getting properties in there. Speaking for myself, I wouldn't rule that out, but I have some issues with the way that that Housing Development Corporation is structured right now, because it wasn't structured to do that type of a project. It was structured to do Golden Hill, and this is a very different type of program. So I'm open, I think, you know, most of us who have been in these conversations are open to hear from the county executive's office mm-hmm. what changes they might propose, mm-hmm. because I could see a scenario where we move forward with the land bank, we move forward with talking with the city of Kingston, and in the interim, we don't hold back on trying to get people in homes, and I would not rule out the Housing Development Corporation as a way to do that if we make some changes.
So that's all good news there, I think, right? You know.
Yeah, I think there have been positive conversations.
I also agree that we can work in three parallel paths at the same time. I mean, and I think that's probably the most constructive thing that we could do, because if the Kingston housing falls apart or ours doesn't materialize, then we still have what the county is doing at the executive level, right? Mm-hmm. And so we just want to keep moving forward, right? Go ahead, Legislative Burke.
Yeah, I just would want to add that, you know, and I also felt that the conversation with Deputy Executive Wright was very positive. And just from my perspective, notwithstanding the fact that this has been before this committee for a couple months without action, you know, there's been behind-the-scenes discussion and behind-the-scenes action, and I think really that time is of the essence in terms of going to City of Kingston with a proposal in order to get a more firm answer on whether or not they're willing to collaborate and reorganize the county-wide organization. And if not, I think that we need to pretty aggressively be more moving forward on the application. And the one thing that I just want to say to the committee and on the record is that I really hope that we can work closely with the executive's office and the executive's team on that application. It's my sense that there's always been the willingness to work from the executive's office perspective on what they see as a parallel path. And from the legislative perspective, I certainly think we'd have a stronger application if we were working with the executive's office on that application. So I'd like to see that work moving forward at a fairly, you know, at a fairly aggressive clip. And the first thing really is to sit down with the City of Kingston with our asks as a county proposing a countywide land bank, a specific ask.
So real quick, Abe and Tracy, so what are the timelines we're looking at from a city, you know, you said maybe making it, there's a point where they're going to make a decision on, and then also what are you looking at from the county land bank being established? So, you know, is there any kind of estimate as to how long that would actually take?
I can call again, but I know when I called ESD and the head of the land bank division there, he told me that from the point of receiving an application, which this is just a precursor to having that application, that it could take 60 days.
Oh.
So it's not.
It's a lot quicker than I thought.
Yeah.
That's good.
But I think an application is a serious undertaking.
Yeah.
I mean, it's for sure.
So any other committee members have anything you want to add to the conversation?
Can I just speak to the other part, is the timing on the city side?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so they've got properties that they're trying to get folks in for right now, and I would say they are encountering something that is unknown, meaning they don't know how hard it's going to be to get people in there to meet the criteria to go through the process. It's not an easy thing.
Mm-hmm.
Once they get people in there and are working through the properties that they have and really are reaching that finish line for a couple of those properties, I think that would probably be the point where they would be making a decision about what to do next, because they are very much mired in a operational challenge of doing property management.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I think that's been a wake-up call for them.
Mm-hmm.
And that running its course is probably where the inflection point is going to be.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Anybody else? No.
I just wanted to clarify, you took that application for the land bank?
Yeah.
Dr. Wright, would you like to add anything at this point?
I agree. We had a really great conversation, and I think pursuing those three strategies in parallel makes the most sense.
Good. Thank you very much for your work, you guys. It's a very important thing that this committee undertakes every month, and I hope we continue to take this kind of action every month, right, until we make greater headway. Right. Thank you.
I'll make a motion. We postpone it until next month.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Thank you. Resolution number 390, which is authorizing the county executive to execute a contract with the New York State Housing Trust Fund Corporation, represented by the Office of Community Renewal, for federal funding for the implementation of Community Development Block Grant CARES Act, amending the 2021 Ulster County Budget, Department of Economic Development.
I'll make a motion for discussion.
Second.
Okay. So I think, Tim, you're going
to
give some background?
To give a little background here.
Go ahead.
Go ahead with the background.
Yeah. So just to reference the another resolution that's before you tonight for a contract with UCEDA for implementation of this program, which has substantial details, including the full program application. So if you want all of the background on the actual program design and the application to the state's Office of Community Renewal, that material is included in that resolution and the supporting documentation. This is a grant application that was funded through the Federal CARES Act stimulus during the pandemic, kind of second wave of stimulus funding, which did not include support for state and local governments, but did include funding for county and local governments, but did include funding for the state. The state chose to allocate that funding through their Community Development Block Grant Program. They made available to counties and towns an opportunity to apply for those funds to help offset the impacts to local businesses as a result of the pandemic. We saw that as an opportunity to apply for support for our local businesses, and were successful in applying for a grant of $1 million, of which $850,000 would go in direct financial support to a select group of businesses, in particular businesses that meet the standards established by HUD for the CDBG program, which is designed to serve low to moderate income households. And so the remaining $150,000 is for program administration and overhead costs related to administering the program. So this resolution is one of two. This would authorize the executive to sign the agreement with OCR, HCR for the CDBG program. And then the second would authorize the disbursement of those funds through a contract to UCEDA to issue small business assistance grants to up to 23 businesses.
So I have a couple of questions, and forgive me because I've been a little out of the loop the last month or two. I don't remember having a public hearing come before us for this. Did I miss that somehow, or?
There was a public hearing. It was authorized under the programmatic resolution that allows us to schedule and hold those public hearings.
So it was the exec that held the public hearing?
No, it was a legislative public hearing.
I don't remember seeing anything on it. So that's just, you know, my question on this, because I don't remember seeing anything. But as it relates to the program itself, I have a number of questions.
And there was an informational meeting I sent out an email about.
Here, but if we're looking to get it approved, one of the things I see that we are talking about 23 companies at 35. That doesn't get us to the 850. So I assume you're expecting some to come back at requesting more than 35,000.
No, I think that was an estimate of the number of businesses that we would assist with a max of 35,000 each. I can't do that math in my head, but I believe
it's
around.
Well, it comes to 805.
Yeah, so
you're shy about 35,000.
So
you
it's
could actually do 24.
It's exactly. It's a minimum of 23 businesses.
Okay. And why are we including startup businesses being eligible for this if it's around trying to help businesses that were hurt by the pandemic and trying to help them build back up, but we're including startup businesses in this?
Remember that one of the caveats and kind of shortcomings a lot of the federal assistance that was available to businesses is it required them to be in existence long enough to show a loss as a result of the pandemic. And what we've heard is that a number of businesses that were established either right before the pandemic or since the pandemic have not been able to take advantage of those programs. Those are considered startups, so that would be our main target, is to make sure that businesses that were started in the last year and a half have an avenue for support.
Okay, not just some startup business that's coming before us now.
It's possible that those would be eligible, those would be considered, but our intent was to make sure that we included those businesses.
I would prefer to see us spending money on people who have been trying to run a business in this community for a period of time, and COVID put a, you know, pop their balloon, versus someone new coming to the area. I mean, are there residency requirements? Like, do they have to be a resident of Ulster County for a year, or, you know, are there anything like that put in? I didn't see anything.
There are two avenues for eligibility for a business. Either the business owner themselves provides tax returns that document, one, that they're a resident of Ulster County, and two, that they fall under the OMI threshold, the low to moderate income threshold. The other avenue is if they certify that 51% or more of their employees are low to moderate, are from low to moderate income households. There is not, in that second case, a requirement that the owners are Ulster County residents, but the desire is to help the business through supporting the employees who are low to moderate income residents here in Ulster County.
Yeah, because that's most of our retail businesses. I don't know any retail business that's paying their employees, even owners, $70,000 or more. So, okay, how will LMI businesses be identified? Do you already have a list of LMI businesses? You're talking about spending $100,000 to go out and market this. How are you going to do that? Is it just through your outreach and emails? Because those don't always reach everyone.
No,
so I'm just trying to understand.
Yep.
And I saw three towns targeted. So are those the only three towns?
No, it's eligible everywhere in the county. Those are three towns that the argument was made explicitly pointing to those towns as having a significant population at or below the low to moderate income thresholds, just to make our application
That's just
in
residents, which are potential employees, is that correct?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Yep, or business owners.
Okay.
So in that case, would be eligible in either case.
Okay.
What was the other part of your question?
Outreach.
How do you do the outreach to identify LMI business?
So there, up to $100,000 of this grant is allowed to be used for program delivery. And so that is an up to amount, and it would allow us to do targeted marketing and promotion of this to make sure that it reaches all of the eligible businesses throughout the county.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Real quick. So then the 150 off the top, and then another 100 out of the 850?
No.
Okay.
100,000 for program delivery,
yeah.
50,000 for program
okay.
administration, and then the remainder, 850,000, goes in direct financial assistance.
Thank
okay.
you.
You're
glad you cleared that up. Thanks.
Okay. A couple other questions, if I may.
Yeah, sure. Go right ahead. Thanks. Sure.
So the startups, one of the things that I just highlighted here that I am concerned about is the, you know, the migration of folks from the city who are starting businesses up here. And I'm not suggesting they should be excluded, but I am suggesting that we focus more on businesses that have been existing in this market for a period of time who could use the help as a result of what happened with COVID. It concerns me that with the migration, we've seen a lot of businesses come here and be established here. And, you know, it's the people in the know that always seem to get these kinds of things. And I want to make sure that we're targeting folks that have lived in this community for a period of time and see if we can give them a leg up, again, to all the things you identified, which is not, you know, their credit scoring, you know, the impact of COVID on their businesses, not having sufficient funds to cover that kind of year and a half, 2 year impact to their business. So I just want us to ensure that we are focusing on the right group of people and businesses that have, you know, have shown potential prior to, which is why I think you're asking for tax returns from 2019.
Well, we are asking for most recent tax returns as a way to document eligibility of the business owner. And so I would just clarify two things. One is that I think your point is well taken and completely agreed, first of all. But I think the question is how do we implement it in a way that's consistent with that desire? And there's two things. One is that depends on how we promote it. And I think that we will take that into consideration as we figure out how to do outreach to make sure that businesses that have been here, that have existed here, have struggled through the pandemic, are aware of this and applying for it. I think we also have to acknowledge that the guidelines for the grant ultimately govern who is eligible for this funding, and we don't have any direct influence over that. That's federal and state regulations on CDBG funds. So I think it's really going to be about how we promote it more than it is about how we either refine eligibility that really isn't in our control.
So real quick question, and maybe Dennis, you can chime in here. So during the pandemic, a lot of businesses went out of business, right? So now, is there any way that this money could be used to reach out to those small businesses, local businesses that had to close their doors,
yes,
and see, hey, are you interested in opening back up?
That is another reason why startups were not categorically ruled out as ineligible is, you know, quite frankly, often what we were saying during the pandemic is that if we can't save the business, can we save the entrepreneur? And I think that that's still a really valid approach. And again, I think our challenge is going to be, it's all about how we make existing businesses that have been here or entrepreneurs that have been here that are a part of our community aware of this application process, because ultimately the eligibility is governed by CDBG, and we're not going to be able to rule out somebody who's new here. We're going to just try to promote it as best we can to the folks that have been here.
So if I can go back to my other question, because I think you kind of touched on it, but I'd like to hear a little bit more. How are you going to identify LMI business? You said you know who they are.
Well, no, I don't okay. believe I know who they are. I think there is a lot of work to do there.
Okay.
I think our approach is going to be first using that available funding that is for promotion of this program to really get the word out and to use channels that we wouldn't normally be able to use, whether that's radio advertisements, newspaper advertisements, things that we would be able to do with this funding that we don't have a budget to do for
other
programs.
What about even reaching out into the chambers?
Yes,
and
exactly.
The
so we've already started conversations with other entities in the county,
business
the chambers, business
association,
SBDC. That will be an important partner here as they counsel many of these businesses,
right.
using them to help us get the word out to their council, their businesses that they're counseling.
So, radio.
Radio, television, through
okay.
associations and
okay.
through our partnerships with other organizations are the immediate approaches, but open to other ideas,
social
even
media.
To the point of working with you in your districts to make sure that we're reaching the businesses mm-hmm. in your district.
Yeah, I think it'd be helpful to even get it out to the supervisors, because I think they have a good sense
they
of what's
yeah,
going
right,
on
exactly.
in their communities as well and who's struggling.
Right.
And because I think this is a great program. I just feel that we need to ensure that we do blanket it in a way that people know about it.
Yeah.
And it's not the usual suspects that come for these kinds of loans.
Mm-hmm. Right. There's a lot more people out there that need help right now than ever
Absolutely.
Before. You
and
know,
we hear it every day.
Right.
And you think you're going to create or at least retain 23 jobs in this process? How'd you kind of figure that one out? I was
well,
just curious.
The obvious reason that we chose that number is because in the worst case scenario, this would be 23
right.
sole proprietors and we would retain those jobs.
Right.
We hope that it'll be more, but we don't want to overcommit to the funder, so that was our logic.
Mm-hmm. Pretty good.
And just a clarification on the tax returns, because I read it two different ways. I read that it could be from January of 2020 through January of 2021, or it could be January 2020 business results and January 2021 business results. So I wasn't quite sure how you were approaching this and what that really meant.
I'm not quite clear either. I'm trying to understand which section you're referring to. But
it's page 57. It's the business assistance section, cost per job. Did I get it from there? Yes. For established businesses, gross first quarter 2020 and 2021. So I guess it's just the first quarter for each of those years would be the comparison?
Yes, that's right. That'll be the comparison. That'll allow us to look
as
at...
As well as federal tax returns.
Yep.
To determine okay. LMI status.
Yes, that's right.
And
so
is that a federal requirement?
Which part?
The federal tax returns for LMI status.
It is a requirement of HCR, the state agency that administers HUD. That was one of their requirements for us as we decided on the eligibility criteria. Either they have to provide a tax return documenting their LMI status, or they have to certify that 51% or greater of their employees are LMI.
Okay. Thank you.
Anyone else? Anybody, anything you want to add? Dennis, no, you good?
I would just say that you know that the job issues with respect to LMI are they available to for LMI individuals, and generally that's an educational attainment.
Mm-hmm.
You can't require a master's degree and then have an LMI. So in some instances, if you're creating jobs, you don't know who's going to take them. So that you look at how they're available, how the jobs are made available.
Mm-hmm.
That's an easy way to do it. And in some instances, when you're looking at tax returns, you're looking at impacts.
Yep.
So helping, making a determination of how you're going to fund a business, you're going to look at the impact of what COVID has on the business itself, which is a comparison that you can do. So there's some really good information you can get out of that. But you should understand that the the eligibility for the jobs are dependent upon what you need in order to take the job.
I would also add, and Dennis was part of our team kind of consulting as we were applying for the grant, and it's worth noting that this is different from other CDBG funds because it's part of the CARES stimulus funding. This will be required to be spent within 12 months of award. So there is a ticking clock on this program.
Okay, Legislator Archer and then Legislator Bartels. Okay.
Yeah, just to clarify a point that, you know, this is a really unique area, and I don't think LMI equates to whether they have a master's degree or a graduate of any college. Up here, people make choices to be in this area and modify their lifestyle, and you can't equate an LMI person to someone who doesn't have a college education. I know many folks that are, you know, that are probably making it that 40,000 who are college graduates but have made choices in their life to live here, be here, etc.
No, it's not. It's the ability to get the job and hold the job. It's the qualifications for the job, not what you have.
Okay, I just
want to
be clear that we.
Yeah.
You know,
no, I completely agree.
Yeah,
somebody
with a 4-year degree can get a job much easier.
Some of these things are deemed to be eligible for LMI people based on the qualifications you need to get the job.
Right. There you go.
Yeah, it's the way that they define it at the state level, and it doesn't always make intuitive sense. But I think we, by virtue of the way that we've proposed the job retention / creation, I think, you know, we can count jobs that are, even if they're held by somebody with a master's degree, if they hold the job, they can be considered low to moderate income if they meet those income thresholds.
Because of the income.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I just wanted to make sure we weren't tying the education together with that. Okay.
Legislator Bartels?
Thank you. I was just going to ask, assuming the outreach is successful and you have a really robust application process, does the application provide for the framework of how you would weigh one application against the next, and also how you would evaluate just how much need each applicant has?
It does. That's a good question, and one that I think we're wrestling with. How will we make, assuming that these funds will be in high demand, and if everybody who applies is asking for $35,000, again, 23 or 24 is the most that we can award. We've asked in the application process, as we've been thinking about it with the funder, how can we identify other characteristics that would allow us to prioritize among the submissions. It's complicated because HCR and CDBG has very strict requirements about that. What I think we're proposing to do is to look at demonstrated need in terms of revenue loss, which we don't want to make that a kind of categorical exclusion, because we know that a lot of businesses, even if they were started by one of these entrepreneurs that closed and then reopened, or a business that is a resident here for a long time that started during the pandemic, was not able to demonstrate loss. So that doesn't mean they weren't hurting. It just means that they weren't in business a year ago to do a comparison year over year. So we want to use that to help establish priority when it comes to, if we have limited funds and have to limit the awards, we're going to use that as priority, but it's not a basis to exclude somebody from eligibility, if that makes sense. And then I think the other thing to point out, and not to open a whole new can of worms, but just to kind of foreshadow what I hope are future conversations, when we see demand exceed our ability to fund with this program, the question will be, what are the other sources of funds that we can use to support these businesses that are in need? We have the revolving loan fund, so we had already identified in here that there's a request above the $35,000 amount. We will look to the revolving loan fund as a possible source to help that business, and would certainly consider that for a business that we can't fund because we've run out of money as well. And then I would also ask that as we continue discussions about the ARP funds, that we think about this as a version of the direct financial assistance that we've contemplated there too.
And can I just ask a follow-on question?
Yeah.
In terms of the awards, how public will they be? I mean, how much of that information will the legislature or the public know who got the awards? How will we be able to analyze the effect of the awards?
Yes, there will be comprehensive records that we have to keep for every awardee. That's a requirement of the funder. And we will be making those awards public. I think we will try to redact as much as appropriate confidential information in the application, such as social security
tax
numbers and other things in the tax return. But the awardees will be public in the amounts that they're awarded and their intent to retain or create jobs, and then the evaluation of whether they did meet those objectives.
Thank you.
Would it be possible to get like a quarterly report to this committee to so we could get a good look at that, you know, just to see how it's going, because you are on a calendar, right?
Yeah, I think
that was my question. Can we get a quarterly update? If this program works well, and in fact, you are looking for money, it would be great to understand, A, how we're helping, how are we measuring the success, what has it done? If we can do some of those things, those are the kinds of things that can be beneficial if you want to extend a program or look at what other options we have available.
Right. Okay, anybody else have anything else? Okay, I'll accept a motion.
It's been moved and seconded for discussion, so you can vote.
For discussion, right, so now.
You can vote on it.
Call vote? Okay, mm-hmm. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, thank you. All right, and then 391 is approving the execution of a contract for $1 million entered into by the county, the Ulster County Development Alliance Department of Economic Development.
Make a motion for discussion.
Second.
Okay.
So on this one, a couple of questions that I have is, you know, who is really going to be running this program? Is it going to be, and I thought we were, there was some discussion about whether or not it could be run out of economic development or it could be run out of USEDA, and because it's one and the same, but what tends to happen in these situations is we kind of move everything there, but then it's all county people that are running it anyway. So I'm just trying to understand why the need to move to USEDA, number one. They're volunteers. You know, there's a board, yes, but most of the folks there are non-paid employees. So I'm just trying to understand why we're moving it there versus running it out of economic development.
It's really about the organizational structure at USEDA. It's not about the staff. Admittedly, that the oversight of the program will be by the Department of Economic Development by virtue of them being the staff that administers USEDA. So it's important to note that in federal programs through HUD, including CDBG, the transition to a sub-recipient is a desirable end state. In particular, given the timeline that the state is under to spend this funding, it's advantageous for them to see it distributed to a sub-recipient that then is responsible for the ultimate recipients to receive the funding. So that's county receives the grant, awards it to a sub-recipient, USEDA, and then USEDA carries out the implementation of the program. It's also, I think, you know, a matter that we've discussed internally and had some, I think, prior discussions with the legislature about the challenges of the prohibition against gifting that the county has. And so we need to tread carefully when we're talking about grants to businesses, and this puts us in a place where we're better able to justify that. These are program grants through USEDA, not direct gifts from the county. Dennis, I know you've kind of thought a lot about this through past HCR and CDBG. Anything you want
to add? Hold on a minute. Any other legislators have any questions? Okay, Lisa Martels.
Go ahead. That's all right. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I know I raised this in the last chair's meeting, and I've asked council, because when I read the federal guidance on the CARES funding, it speaks about municipalities administering the grants directly. So I was wondering if there was any carve out from the state constitution, given that we're in a global pandemic, that would allow for us to do that, because it just made logical sense to me for the reasons. Legislator Archer said that if we were able to do that in this one circumstance, that it would make sense to have the Department of Economic Development do that. It's my very last minute recent understanding from legislative counsel that he at least initially concurs that the gifting clause, that there is no carve out, and that would preclude us from doing it. But you know, I feel like this, like the overlap becomes, and that, let me just back up and say that then frees me up to be much more open to USEDA doing it if we're not able to, because I felt very much that if we were, it should be the Department of Economic Development taking ownership and making those connections. And I'm just going to say it becomes confusing to me with the overlap of players, because if the prohibition on it is the gifting clause, we do have board members on USEDA who are sitting at this table who are set to vote on it, who are legislative members. You know, and we're prohibited from gifting, but they're also the board members that are then going to have a. So I feel like we're in a weird circumstance, which I hadn't thought of until this minute, but I'm just saying it out loud because the two of you are here, that I just don't know what the legal advice would be on that, because you're board members who are going to be voting on a million-dollar contract in which you're then going to be gifting.
Person.
I mean, so I feel like you should get legal advice on that, because I would have called either of you sooner if I had thought of it. I just didn't think of it until listening to Legislator Archer talk about the complications of the overlap of players.
And even you know, kind of adding on to that, Article 2 in the service agreement or professional service agreement with USITA talks about if there's an extension, it's at the sole discretion. Again, that would preclude it from coming back here, having an understanding of why it's being extended or what we're doing, and it can all happen and we would never understand or know. And I'm not suggesting that you wouldn't fill us in, it's just that the way this is written, you're not required to. And so I'd like to see it be required. If you're going to extend it another year, and if you are going to do something different, it shouldn't be just at the sole discretion of purchasing or the Department of Economic Development. It should be with legislative knowledge.
I don't have anything to say there. This is, by the way, I think as, at least in the copy that I'm looking at, this is in blue, which means that it's part of the optional additions to our standard county contract. I would have to talk to the county attorney about whether that's actually a necessary statement in this. We know that the funding is only available for...
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah, that's what throws me, right? It shouldn't be at the sole discretion.
There should be some legislative oversight on any kind of extension or renewal or what have you, or extra money that comes our way.
Okay, I didn't print that in color, I'm sorry.
No, so, yeah, let me just ask a question. So when does this money have to be spent by?
July 2022.
Okay, so then I just move that we strike that extension. If it has to be spent by July 14th of 2022, the contract begins October 1st, 2021, and ends July 22nd, 2022. End
but
of story.
As we've all seen, contracts get extended. I think he was trying to facilitate that, right? So all I'm saying is if you want to do that, that's fine, but it still should, it shouldn't be
at the sole discretion of
UC. There should be a follow-up with the legislature so we understand why it's being extended and if any additional monies have been added or not spent. So,
yeah.
I mean, I'm sure that if we're getting quarterly updates, that's
right.
going to happen. I just want to be very clear in a service agreement.
So,
yeah, go ahead.
If I may, that clause is a standard clause in all the contracts that the county has. And what you don't want to have happen is, effectively, in order for us to essentially extend the deadline for USITA to do that, we're actually going to have to extend the deadline for the state contract as well.
Right.
So, what you don't want to have happen is extend the deadline for the state contract and not have a valid contract between yourself and USITA. So, I would suggest that flexibility with the idea that if there is an extension, there's a reporting back structure, but that the extension should stay because it literally is a standard piece of language that's in all of our contracts. And I wouldn't want to find ourselves in a situation where we've asked the state for extension, but we can't continue to work because USITA doesn't have a contract, and we're 30 days or 60 days out to amend that contract.
Is that common or uncommon to ask for extension?
I can tell you that we've extended, during the COVID issue, we've extended the housing rehabilitation contract.
Forget COVID. Normally, though.
Yeah, there are, because things happen. And in particular, even because COVID is not here, you may run into situations where effectively you can't get materials or something of that nature because of supply chain issues. May not apply here, but I mean, these kinds of things do get extended, and they're short extensions. They're 3-month extensions, is when we ask for them. The state will generally not give you more than 3 months at a time.
Okay.
They want the money spent.
And all I'm saying is that, and we've had this debate and conversation over the years, it's about moving quickly. And again, the only reason that we don't move quickly is when we're not informed. So all I'm asking is that we be kept informed, number one, And that if you want that language in there, it's not at your sole discretion. It's just making sure everybody's in the loop. I don't know how you want to craft it, but again, it happens more often than not. And all I'm saying is, if we're all trying to work better together, that should come across in this as well.
Let's
why don't we put two legislative members on the UCEDA board so that it has a legislative component? Isn't that why we're appointed to the board?
Yes, it is.
When was the last time we all got an update?
Tim makes them regularly.
Yeah.
Legislator Cahill?
Yes. Yeah,
if I might speak to the question Legislator Bartel raised.
Sure, go right
ahead. I think it's a great idea for us all to sit down with legislative counsel in the county attorney's office and talk the questions you have through. We've talked about this extensively with the county attorney, and it's really important that we all get on the same page about it, that this is the reason we have a local development corporation. That's what this tool is for, and that's why we have legislators on the board. So that there is that relationship. So I think that would be a really valuable conversation. In view of the time frame that we have on this, I hope we don't need to postpone for a month to have that conversation. But I think you know, getting sort of that big picture of like what's the tool for and what's the legal structures that set that up would be super helpful.
Any other discussion?
I'll make the motion that.
You can just call the question.
I think we can. If you want, I'll make the motion that we strike that blue language in Article 2 of the service agreement.
There's an amendment on the floor. All those in favor of the amendment of striking the time that gives the county the sole discretion of extending the contract for 1 year, that would be stricken from the contract. All those in favor of that? I'm going to be a no only because of what Planner Doyle said, because if they ask for an extension and then this contract doesn't support it, then they're kind of
hosed. Yeah, but he just said it's 3 months. 3 months is about all they give you, but this says a year. So
okay, so...
Just to clarify, the amendment was moved by Archer, seconded by anybody? I didn't hear anybody
second
the amendment?
I'll second the amendment.
So, I mean, I think is it the issue with the county having the sole discretion, or is it with the length of time?
It's a sole discretion for a year to renew a contract that any other renewal comes before us. The only time during COVID it didn't, it was under executive order. And we found out after the fact.
Right.
So I'm not quite sure why this is a problem, or why it has to be added this way. It still would have to come before us, and people have, usually you get plenty of notice, and or there's a process for late resolution. So I'm not quite sure why, for an extension of a year at their sole discretion without coming back here is an issue. That's our job.
Yeah, not here. Any other discussion on the amendment? Okay, all those in favor of the amendment?
Aye.
Aye.
I'm opposed.
Then opposed? We have Legislator Litz, Legislator Mayo. So we are going to strike that from the contract, the year extension. Thank you.
Thank you.
On the amended resolution, all those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, thank you. All right, so now we're going to go on to 392. Which is approving the execution of a contract for $1 million entered into by the county and RUPCO Incorporated for the Department of Planning.
I was just going to mark this up.
I'll move it. A second.
Okay. Any discussion? Okay, all those in favor? Sorry, I didn't see
it. It's not $1 million, just so you know. The title of that should be changed. It's only $600,000.
No, it is $600,000.
Yeah.
Yeah, on the agenda.
On agenda, it says $1 million, but
I apologize.
It's only $600,000.
Okay, so let me make sure we have that on the record correctly. Then, I say approving the execution of a contract for $600,000 entered into by the county with RUPCO Incorporated for the Department of Planning. I'll accept a motion.
Is that how it's stated in the resolution that we'll sign?
It says 50,000 and then 600,000, yes.
On the title?
Yep.
Is the title correct?
Yeah, it's just the agenda.
I'm sorry, I must have, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the resolution is correct.
I couldn't figure out what was...
However, the header is also...
The header is incorrect,
right.
Probably.
So do we, is that, does that matter?
No, we can correct it.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay, so all those in favor? Unless there's any questions? No? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? No. Okay, thank you. Resolution 393, which is authorizing the chairman to execute an intermunicipal agreement with the New York State Department of Information Technology Services to provide updated ortho imagery for the county department of IS. Okay. Second?
Second.
Any discussion?
I just can't tell you how critical updated ortho imagery is. It is literally the lifeblood of making decisions from a planning perspective and some of the economic development perspective, and the current ortho imagery we have is 2016. So the idea of essentially getting this and getting it at the level of detail you're talking about, which is down to several pixels, is really important issue.
I just want to mark this one up.
Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Great, great, thank you. 394, which is approving the execution of a contract amendment for $565,000 and 4 cents entered into the county by Boya BP and Brett Incorporated, doing business as Newcastle Communication Department of IS. Is that voice over IP or something?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so it's phone services. Accept a motion?
I'll move it for discussion.
Second.
Any discussion? All right. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. And our last resolution is resolution number 395, which is setting a public hearing on proposed law, local law number 7 of 2021, a local law amending the code of the County of Ulster in relation to evictions, to be held on Tuesday, October 19th, 2021, at 7:05 p.m. Second? Any discussion on that one? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, if I may speak to it.
Sure.
Sorry.
So in a moment, I'm going to ask for postponement so that we don't, you know, have to move with haste on this, because this is a very significant piece of legislation that would provide a lot of clarity to tenants and to landlords about the way that evictions will proceed when the moratorium is lifted. I know many people believe the moratorium should be extended indefinitely. I think that this is much more fair to landlords than doing that.
Okay.
And I'm also eager to hear what folks from every caucus, Republican, Democrat, and pizza, might have to provide in terms of further crafting this, because I realize that this is something that on a countywide basis is going to affect a pretty wide population. I think this is a population that is very vulnerable right now, and so rather than try and move with haste, I'd like to move with a deliberate manner and really give an opportunity for folks to read the law. Tenants still have to pay rent. This is not taking away the landlord's ability to evict for failure to pay rent. You can still take into consideration improvements to a property when you're increasing the rent. This really just makes it something that judges consider. They consider the situation that the landlord is in with the improvements that they've made to the property. They consider the situation that the tenant is in with a variety of factors. And so I'm very open to feedback on this, and I would ask that we hold it this month and keep working on it.
I'll take my thing back and make a motion to postpone.
Okay. Second on the postponement?
I'll second.
Okay. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay.
And I will, if I may, I am very curious what folks in the Republican caucus might have to add on this. I've shared it with Ken. Please share what I have just said with everybody, and I'm really open to talking about it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the nature, the the nature of what this is going to do is prevent bad landlords from taking advantage of tenants because of the situation they're in now, right? I mean, this doesn't harm landlords in any way. It helps tenants, it protects tenants from bad landlords, right? Good landlord doesn't have a thing to worry about, right? Is that a fair statement?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And if anyone feels that we've missed anything here, you know, please, you know, take a look at it. It's written in pretty plain English, and it's also, you know, this is not, everything still works through the courts. You know, evictions still are going to go through the courts. This just gives the judges a request that they look at a variety of these other factors that are outlined here.
Right. It's not just about paying rent, right, sometimes.
Yeah,
right?
And you still have to pay rent, and, yeah. And anyone who's not paying rent, and, you know, that's not a viable solution for them. And it still would not be with this law.
Right.
Yeah,
are both councils
going to
look at it? I mean, I know they should look at it.
Yeah, yeah, they have. And I think, and the other, and also the county attorney
mm-hmm.
as well. Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, so I've asked Councilor Ragucci to share this, you know,
okay.
widely.
So
yeah.
Albany County has enacted this, correct?
Albany City has enacted this, right?
And is there, have they had any kind of results, you know, as far as having to use it, or has it helped, you know, prevent, you know,
so
some action?
There's an eviction moratorium right now.
Right, so
and
don't
the,
know
the New York State, so this is what's interesting about the overlapping eviction moratorium. So the federal eviction moratorium, which doesn't really have much force because of the Supreme Court ruling, stops evictions from being executed, right? Which is basically just stopping the sheriff from showing up at your house
mm-hmm.
or stopping potentially the judge from signing the order. The state eviction moratorium stops eviction proceedings from beginning. So right now in New York State, evictions are not moving through the system. They're not starting or being, it's kind of like the federal, if you can think about it this way, the federal moratorium, it means that there's a queue at the starting line of evictions that are waiting to begin. Rather, sorry, the federal moratorium is that the evictions are queuing at the finish line, waiting to be executed, whereas the state moratorium is that the evictions are queuing at the starting line. So once the moratorium lifts, they're all going to be working their way through the courts. And I don't think the Albany law has been actually put to practice because evictions are not moving through the courts there
mm-hmm.
because of the moratorium. And so when, rather than extend the moratorium, which as it draws near, there is going to be a cry to extend the moratorium, which obviously is not fair to landlords.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. So this just gets people back on track when they're doing everything that they can do to work with the tenants and not doing anything, not trying to raise the rent by 100% or something like that. Which, by the way, if you did raise a rent by 100% in my district, someone would come and pay it.
That's right.
And then my mm-hmm. constituent would be out on the street and DSS would put them in a hotel in Greene County, and that is happening to too many people.
And you have a new constituent.
Well, this is what I said. I have said this in the past. What is happening in my district is basically replacing my constituents with more affluent class of constituents. But quite frankly, those are not the people that I was elected to represent. I was elected on a specific date by a specific set of people, and those are the people I want to represent, not necessarily the folks coming here, although I do advocate that everyone that comes here registers to vote.
Legislator Archer?
I do think it also provides, because of the way in which New York it really kind of starts to move things through the system at a slower pace because it's all going to be, but it allows remedies to take place prior
yeah.
to getting to court.
Right.
And
yes. That's what I'm thinking.
And I think, because I've had a couple of landlords in my community complaining that they're saying, oh, well, we don't have to pay. New York told us we don't have to pay.
And
the landlord saying, no, you have to pay.
You have to pay.
And you're going to have to pay at some point.
Right.
And so I think what this will do, and I think that's encouraging, is start to let people know that you're going to have to pay, and if you don't, you're going to get evicted.
Yeah.
Right.
And the taxes come tomorrow,
yeah.
and if they don't pay till August of next year, you're in default. And
right.
So you don't have a landlord anymore, but you're still living in that apartment.
Emma will have another house.
Are we doing anything for landlords that are in a situation with, I mean, they still have 3 years, but it's like the back taxes and all that.
Nope.
I mean, it starts to pile up.
Yeah, we should look at that. We should find out if we're in arrears on, if there are landlords.
Well, the ERAP, I mean, I believe ERAP can be used for landlords. So
direct payment to landlords.
Yeah, but not on the taxes. Yes.
But I will.
We don't want that.
But I will tell you the reality of the situation. I've had two tenants tell me that they didn't have to pay their rent. I explained to them they need to check into it because the rent is being deferred, but you're going to have to pay it
at some point.
And when they found out that, you know, in another 4 or 5 months they're going to have to pay $4,000 or $5,000 of which they don't have, and hey, they move out. You don't have to evict them. Matter of fact, the eviction you don't even need to do, because they move out and just stick you with the money that you don't get.
I never thought of that until you just said that.
Oh, it happens.
Happens all the time.
I've had two do it.
Two out of how many total? Just for
what's that?
Statistical purposes. Two out of how many total do you have?
I have four people.
Okay.
So it's 50%.
Well, I would say, and this is just, you know, my personal experience, most of the people I know who have rentals said that they've had regular collections. They're not seeing a lot of people not pay. But I don't have a huge net here.
In some pockets, it's a mixed bag, and some of it really has to do with not having a job. During COVID. Yeah. So
you know, and I was very sympathetic. The one lady is
you want to help them
is an aide in the school, and during COVID, she was at home doing nothing. She said, "I can't pay the rent." Okay, what am I going to do?
Looking at our sales tax number,
and then she came to me and said, "But the state law and the federal law says I do not have to pay you rent." And I said, "No. What it says is your rent payment is deferred. So when that is over, which was like April, in April you're going to owe me $4,000." No, I says, "Please do your research." She contacted me a week later and said, "I'm moving in with a lady that I used to work with. I'm going to live in a room in her house because she's going to help me out. Hopefully in the future I can pay you your rent." That was about a year ago now, maybe a little more. I don't expect I'll ever see that money.
Have you applied for ERAP?
No.
So one of the things I would suggest is that I would run the law by Hudson Legal Services because they do a lot of representation.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And they help the DSS. And we also have an emergency. We have an emergency program which is designed to make sure that the tenants are not unfairly evicted. That's running through social services right now.
They're going to get bombarded there.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Legal services.
Oh, like Peter Frank.
Frank. Yeah. And I know Peter well. So sorry.
Yeah.
You're right.
And we're getting phone calls from landlords who have had tenants who actually sublet their apartments, collected rent from the subletter, and still didn't pay the rent. I've got a landlord who called me who got a judgment against the tenant. The tenant moved out, did tremendous damage to the property, and they got a judgment against them, but they moved to another county. So now, in order to collect on the judgment, they have to locate this tenant in another county. They have to find out where this tenant is working so they can attach their wages. And they have to file, they've already filed in Ulster, they got to file it in that county, and however that gets done in that county. And I can tell you, as a landlord, an eviction can take up to 10 months right now with a judge saying I have good cause. I had a tenant when my husband died who said she wasn't going to pay rent anymore because I didn't need the money. My husband had life insurance. And it took me 8 months to get her evicted. She had no money, and my attorney said, "Let's just get her out of there," you know, and I got nothing for it.
And no, that's not true. How much did you pay your attorney?
I lost 8 months worth of rent, and then I bought a roll-off for her to put all of her, she was a hoarder, for her to put all of her stuff in. So we're getting phone calls from several landlords.
Yeah, we'll reach out to him.
So we have three more agenda items, and one is old business. Any old business? Any new business? And then the last one is...
I'll make a motion for adjournment.
All right. Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
And thank you all very, very much. I appreciate it.
And I apologize. Who moved 92 and 93?
Rupko.
Yeah.
I think Lisa.